Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
866-999-4626 is our number for your comments, questions, or stories this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So I hear you had an interesting breakfast, you and your little Phoebe, this morning. You've got a screech owl in your yard?
Yeah, it was a real zippity-doo-dah morning overall. But yes, right before we drove here, Mass Audubon's Long Pasture Sanctuary right now, looking across at Sandy Neck on this gorgeous morning. But, you know, 45 minutes ago, we were on the deck, and I heard a screech owl call, which is weird for, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. And our screech owl that lives in our box was poking her head out. And I recently figured out that I think for the first time, I think we've had the box up for like 6 years, that for the first time, I think there's a nest in there. There's probably eggs and maybe even babies now.
Ooh, how exciting.
Get up there and check. I wish I had a camera on it. But it is exciting. I've been waiting a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And we would get teased, you know, a bird would come in March and call from the box, but then nothing would really happen. It would sort of disappear. But this year, like, it was back on New Year's Eve. A pair was calling back and forth to each other, and then one of them ended up in my box, and the other one came in real close, and they were doing all these little nesty calls you don't normally hear the screech owls doing. I was really excited, but then nothing for months. And then it turned out one had been in there quietly every day. And then I saw the other night, Phoebe and I were doing dinner with the screech owl because it was poking out and calling, and another bird came in and did a food drop. It's exciting stuff. So other people, they get the nest cameras, like the doorbell cameras. It's kind of funny that's the name of the company that people are putting in their nest boxes. But those like secure home security cameras and putting them in their screech owl boxes. And somebody's been constantly posting photos and videos of their screech owl nest on one of the Facebook groups, Cape Cod Raptors or something like that. And they just had their fuzzy little chicks hatch. I think four of them. And so, yeah, that's the time we are in the cycle. So I'm wondering if there are little babies in there.
How exciting would that
Phoebe,
be?
Yeah, my 5-year-old is very tickled. There might be owlets.
So cute. And so many people. That's common, right? People put these the boxes up, and they sometimes have to wait a while.
Yeah, screech owls are super common. They have plenty of places to nest. Think of all the trees that died during the spongy moth now outbreaks several years ago that killed all the trees. I mean, there are so many cavities now for cavity nesting birds like screech owls, but they do like the boxes, and some people get them right away. And I've always hated those people. But now I can relax.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure I have a nest.
Oh, that'd be, you'll have to keep us updated on that.
So,
all right.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other, everybody loves those hummingbirds. They're back.
Oh, yeah. They're back. And so the first sighting that I know of on the Cape was April 17th. And that's pretty typical. It sounds early. But if you go to I always forget the name of the website, just Google hummingbird migration map. There's this website that tracks the progress of ruby-throated and hummingbirds in the east with little icons as they move north with dates. And it's very typical. The Cape will get a mid-April first record. But the average person, even if you put your feeder out in mid-April, you're not that likely to see one. And most people know you start seeing them. The beginning of May is really when you start seeing them in earnest. Mm-hmm. I'm still not seeing them necessarily every day, but... But they're certainly back, and if you have your feeders out, you should definitely be seeing them.
Yeah,
and I'm sure their females are probably making nests, and the males saw the male doing his display in our rhododendron where he often does it, where he's displaying to some invisible female. He's mm-hmm. making these little clicking sounds. He's flying this big dramatic J shape, like up and down and up and down, and that's their display. You don't have much of a song. So he uses what he has, which is incredible flying skills, to just circumscribe this J-shaped pattern over and over again in the air. And a lot of hummingbirds have these display flights they do.
Well, to keep my eyes open for that. Dan has his feeder out. He says he's seeing a number of hummingbirds in his yard. So
yeah, and you know the funny. So Sue Finnegan is a bird bander. She's one of two licensed hummingbird banders in the state, and so she will band them at her house at the feeders. And I don't know. What do I have two? I don't know. But when you band them. People who've done this, you'd learn that they're way more than you think, and they're just cycling through, and they're coming from different directions. And, you know, you think, oh, there's my female hummingbird. But there's really 12 female hummingbirds that visit your feeder over the course of a day, you know, maybe. So, yeah, it's hard to know just how many there are, but they do well. They like suburbia. It's one of these birds that is doing well with how we have changed the landscape.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned they don't have much of a song, but we are hearing a lot of bird song, changing bird song, as we hear more and more birds come back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every day, literally right now. I mean, this is just the time in the annual birding calendar. I mean, things are just changing so rapidly. It's very different than in fall. In fall, it's kind of a slow developing thing. But in spring, it's just like these big changes, like overnight. And it all happens very quickly over the course of about a month and a half. And so, you know, in April, the resident birds are very active, very vocal. The ones that either don't migrate or don't migrate very far, like robins and song sparrows and, you know, cardinals and woodpeckers and chickadees and titmice and things that don't migrate at all, mourning doves, they're all very vocal. And so that they sort of dominate the dawn chorus, the morning song you're hearing. And then that changes. Around, you know, May 1st, the catbirds come back, towhees, great-crested flycatchers. And so now we have so many catbirds on the Cape. It's not necessarily like that on the mainland, but you just walk out the door and there's just catbirds. You can't hear anything else. catbirds. And they're fooling Merlin. We should talk about Merlin at some point. But they definitely fool Merlin because they make all these crazy sounds. You know, they make so many different sounds that Merlin thinks it's other birds. But yeah, so and then now, so that's the beginning of May. These new arrivals start dominating the dawn chorus, and the birds that were singing a lot in April are now busy with chicks. A lot of them, cardinals, and now. As of the last 2 days in my yard, my neighborhood, the migrant warblers have finally gotten here. And I'm psyched. I'm psyched, Mindy. It's what we wait for. And so all these birds that sort of pass through in May on their way further north, like 30 species of warblers and tanagers and grosbeaks, things like that.
Wow.
Most of them are nesting here.
30 species of warblers?
Well, there's more species of warblers than that, but I think that's... You're not going to see that many in a spring necessarily, unless you're super birder. Mm. But yeah, there are a lot of species of warblers, and most of them don't breed on the Cape. They're going to, you know, spruce bogs in Canada and Western Mass, things like that. We have a handful of warblers breed on the Cape, but most of these migrants are just passing through. And so we get this limited window. That's the thing. It's like limited time only. Blackburnian warbler. Get it now. And so that's where we're at. And so you have to savor these things. And so yesterday morning, and I've been sort of despondent, you know, every morning, the first 11 days of May, I'm just like waiting for some evidence of migration. It's just the same. The catbirds and the orioles, they're awesome. But, you know, I'm waiting for some of these sexier things to be coming through. And then yesterday, finally, I was out walking for a while. And I finally heard a Nashville warbler singing in my neighbor's yard. And that was like, ding, ding, ding. It was like the starting bell for my neighborhood for warbler migration. Like, finally. Yeah. And then a blue-headed vireo was singing and a blackpoll. And it sort of went from there. And then this morning, it was significantly better. I just opened the door. You know, I'm getting Beckett ready to get on the bus, whatever, 6:30. And it's just... black-throated green warblers, northern perulas, blackpoll warblers, black and white warblers, all just buzzing in my yard and all around the neighborhood. It's just fantastic. And you couple that with this weather.
Oh, yeah.
And then stuff like our redbud is in full bloom, eastern redbud, one of our most beautiful native trees, you should really, if you have room for one, you got to get it. You got to get a redbud.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they're not native to the Cape necessarily, but they're an Eastern U.S. native. You pick up in a nursery, just fantastic. Get a flowering dogwood if you can find one of the resistant varieties. Those are our two most beautiful native trees, in my opinion, that are you can plant in your yard and that are just in full bloom right now. Just adding to that May aesthetic that. You know, we earned this, Mindy. Us year-rounders.
Yes, right.
You know,
that's
all
right.
You people, all you people who are just rolling in, it's getting trafficky now, and it's all those people rolling back in from Florida. Like, we earned this. These are our flowers and our birds.
That's right. All right.
You didn't earn these the way we did.
Yeah.
Toughing it out in February on Cape Cod. It's bleak. Bleak here, I tell you.
Yeah, and then the daffodils pop up, and we start seeing color, and the red buds, and the birds. Yeah, it's funny. At my house, of course, I'm like half asleep as the birds are starting in the early morning, and I hear the crows and the mourning doves.
Beautiful, the beautiful dawn chorus.
I do love the mourning doves, though. They do make a beautiful sound.
Yeah. Phoebe's favorite bird.
Oh, really? Interesting.
I was working the other day, and I just hear her calling back and forth with a mourning dove.
Oh, that's funny.
At the other end of the house, she's just like, ooh. And then the dove would call back, mourning dove.
Yeah.
She often does that the first thing in the morning when she wakes up. She does a mourning dove call.
Why not, right? All right, so Joe in West Harwich has written to us. He says, it was a busy month for Eversource in Harwich. I reported 3 dangerous osprey nests on Route 28 telephone poles that crews cleared and installed those black plastic deterrents. It would be great to get an osprey nest pole group like they have in Falmouth organized in Harwich. Also, the glossy ibis has returned to Bell's Neck in West Harwich. Finally, I observed about a dozen piping plovers on a short stretch of beach in Harwich Port last Wednesday. Joe, thanks for the report. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we're lucky in Falmouth to have that group that's looking out for the osprey.
Yes. Just sort of taking those quick. Yeah, that's a lot of piping plovers for Harwich. I used to be in charge of like Red River, which didn't even really have them back then, 15 years ago, and Bank Street, Merkel, all those. I used to be in charge of those places, but 12.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the populations, it continues to go up. I mean, it's really a fantastic success story. Piping plovers are doing great.
So that's good to see 12 is a good thing.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, that might have been a group of migrants, or them. I don't know. Maybe it was 6 pairs, you know. And usually there are males right now that are kind of trying to get themselves a female and causing trouble. And so if you spend some time on a beach right now with nesting piping plovers, just sit and watch them, which is a fun thing to do. You'll see the males posturing and chasing each other around and doing this parallel running thing they do. This very like puff out your chest and you know. And then you run and stop and run and stop, and they're sort of delineating the borders of their territories. And then they do this figure eight flight with this piping call they do, where they literally fly in a figure eight over and over again. Mm. It's just a cool thing to spend time. You know, people hate piping plovers for whatever, if you drive on Nauset or something.
How can you hate them? They're so cute.
People do. But they're inconvenienced by them. Yeah. They like wildlife. They're not inconvenienced by, or they perceive themselves to be inconvenienced by them. But rarely is that actually true. But they're just spend some time. Just sit and watch them. That's what I tell my staff. I'm training staff on monitoring plovers. Like, best thing to do is just sit, like get back to a point where they're not really reacting to you at all. Just kind of sit and watch them. And they do all kinds of fun little things. The osprey thing, every town, like the further out you go on the Cape, I think the higher the growth rate lately.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the upper Cape has just been exploding with ospreys for years and just gotten to this point where there's almost too many, right, in terms of nesting in dangerous situations and having to get them off power poles and all that, trying to keep up with all that. And we're getting to that point on the outer Cape. They're still sparse. You know, there's still less than 10 nests in Truro, and I don't know of any in Petetown, which is bizarre. You know, you're sitting in Falmouth thinking about there's no osprey nests in Provincetown.
Like, I know, right?
there might be now, but I'm not aware of any. And so it tapers off as you go out. But when you that upper Cape region, is there's so many ospreys. And as far as Harwich and Orleans and into East Ham, it's just gotten to that point. Yes, we need a version of the Falmouth Osprey project, which just kind of happenstance developed with this guy Kevin Friel, who's a professional and a professional photographer and kind of amateur bird. Well, he's a professional photographer all around, and he was photographing all the osprey nests in Falmouth one year, several years ago, and that coincided with the year that Eversource, this ill-fated effort to get osprey nests off the power lines, just ripped down a bunch of nests and didn't put up effective deterrents, and it was an absolute disaster. It was a disaster for electrical grid reliability with fires. It was a disaster for birds getting killed, mm-hmm. and the amount of work it ended up creating. It just wasn't, and they know this. This was, you know, and so we've been trying to do better, meeting with them, trying to do better ever since. But Kevin and a woman named Barbara Schneider got together and just took matters into their own hands in Falmouth to put up, and then involving the community and putting up alternative poles in situations where they are on dangerous power lines. And so, and then the role of Eversource is to come in and take down the nest and put up an effective deterrent. That's right. The key. Yep. Give them a safe alternative place to nest, effectively deter that pole, and often you have to do adjacent ones because mm-hmm. they could just move down the line if they're the kind that have a double cross arm. Not every pole can host an osprey nest, but when you look at our electrical grid, we basically built our electrical grid out of osprey platforms. This is not a problem that's going away. And there weren't that many ospreys when the grid got built out, and so it didn't happen very much, and nobody really thought about it. But all these old poles with double wooden cross arms, that looks like a dead tree, or an osprey platform. And so this problem is not going away, and I don't think they're going to bury the lines or switch to single cross arms on every pole on the cable.
Yeah. Wow.
Soon. So it's just going to, it's a continuing problem that, you know, Falmouth has a good solution. We need a Falmouth Osprey project in every town to be a Bourne Osprey project and a Mashpee and then moving out on the Cape.
Yep. Joe, thanks for the email. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Mark, swallow-tailed kites on the Upper Cape, sixth year in a row?
That might be right. Did I say that?
You did say that.
That's probably right then.
Yeah, you must
sometimes
be right.
Sometimes I'm right. So, yeah, it just doesn't seem that long, but that's how it is. It's just bizarre. It's just an absolutely bizarre ornithological story, improbable. And so swallow-tailed kites, you know, it's always been something that you hope to see on a bubble of warm air in May or even April into June here on the Cape. These kites are southern birds mostly, and swallow-tailed kites are particularly southern. Like, the average swallow-tailed kite in the world lives in Brazil or Venezuela or something. And then their breeding rate extends up into Florida and Georgia, South Carolina. But then they go back to South America in the winter. So they're not exactly cold hardy. Mm-hmm. But in recent years, these sort of spring swallowtail kites that you hope to see have kind of stayed in this like rectangle shaped area of the upper east of Mashpee Wakeby Pond, from South Sandwich down to Mashpee and over to Marston's Mills and Katuit Osterville area. And this year it's been centered around Santuit Pond in Mashpee, and two were seen there yesterday or the day before. And so the weirdest thing happened several years ago, where someone looked out in their backyard and saw two swallow-tailed kites mating in a tree in their backyard. I think it was in South Sandwich. You could have knocked me over with a feather. Just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right? Again, the nearest substantial breeding area is South Carolina, and they get up into the southern part of North Carolina.
Right.
But I was kind of looking at records, and I did the math recently. in one of the weekly bird reports, you're based on eBird data, you're more likely to see a swallowtail kite in like Mashpee or Marston's Mills in June than you are in North Carolina the last several years. And
That's
so
crazy.
they just seem to be settling in, and if somebody can find a nest, it would just be incredible. So please keep an eye out. And, birders are certainly keeping an eye out, and they've been seeing them a lot kind of near the herring run, it sounds like, at Santuit Pond area. And so just, keep your eyes on the road when you're
Yeah.
driving, but,
But otherwise, if yeah, and if you see a
but do
nest,
keep an
yeah.
eye out. You're going down 28 in that area. Keep an eye out for swallowtail kites. And so that was several years ago that they were copulating, and but that was really late. That was just recreational mating, to put it delicately, because it was much too late in the season for them. They nest in April.
Right.
They nest in like maybe even March down in Florida in April. They do come back fairly early, and they leave early. So by August, they're heading back to South America, and I think this was in early August or late July. But just the number of sightings over that area, I'm sure it's multiple birds. And apparently, in the 19th century, they nested up as far as Minnesota, like
Really,
up the
huh?
Mississippi River. But then they declined. Their
Right.
range contracted and numbers declined severely since then.
Right.
So they have it in their DNA to nest in more northerly places. And so maybe this is
Yeah,
like
maybe
this
this is the
Upper
beginning of,
Cape.
yeah.
The swallowtail kite district of the Upper Cape is where they're sort of
Yeah.
reclaiming that old heritage that's sleeping in their DNA to nest this far
Yeah.
north.
All right, we got a couple of phone calls and a couple of emails. Let's start with Ed in Harwich. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. Just on the heels of the conversation regarding the osprey nests, my daughter and I were traveling down Lothrop south towards 28 last week, and we noted an osprey over the marsh, which is kind of the eastern side of Bell's Neck. And the bird had a fish, and we were kind of excited to see that. And then the next thing that was kind of astounding was that we saw the bird sweep in to the left of us off the road, and they landed in their nest that was actually in a tree. And my
No
daughter
way.
actually said it. Yeah. My daughter said it before as I was thinking it. She said, "Oh my goodness, they're in a tree." And I think just personally for me, that was the first time I actually saw an osprey in something other than a nest pole or on top of a telephone pole. So it was kind of
Yes.
neat to see. It's like there's a dead kind of, like you said, to your point, Mark, a dead it was a dead pine tree right there. It was kind of neat. It's
Wow.
and it's there. We
And
drive
so
by it regularly, and we always slow down to check it out and see what's going on.
wow, no, I know. It's funny. It's funny how rare it is to see them in a tree. To some extent, it's harder to see the tree nest if it's in a tree that's still alive. That's part of it. But really, it's because overwhelmingly they're not nesting in trees. They're nesting on platforms that we've put out and power poles and the lights at the baseball field and cell phone towers and that kind of thing. Where is this again? So
Exactly.
this is where Lothrop meets 28, somewhere down there.
So if you were, if you were going south on Lothrop from Great Western Road, it's prior to where the Harwich Conservation Trust land is there on the left, and it's actually pretty distinct. There's an area where the trees go from kind of like pine forest to deciduous trees. So it's right there. It's probably, three quarters of the way down the road on the left.
All right, good to
All
know.
right.
And I'm
Ed, thanks
asking
for
because
sharing.
I,
Yeah.
yeah, thanks, Ed. I have a
All right.
project where I try to inventory every nest on the Cape, which is basically impossible.
Yeah.
But I've been trying to update. I do have an inventory of 400 plus nests, and I'm sure there's 500 plus in reality. And I've been updating that and adding to it. And I know this is not one that I have. I'm pretty sure this is not one I have in
All
my
right.
database.
Yeah.
So
So, Ed, thank you
maybe I'll
for
swing
helping
by.
update Mark's list. All right, let's
Yes.
talk to Colleen, who's calling from Marston's Mills. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, good morning. I was
Morning.
my mom lives in Kitsuit, and we have recently had a visit by the largest goldfinch I'd ever seen. And I did some Googling on it, and it came up. There was they call it fat finch disease. I was wondering, we pulled down the window feeder. It was called fat finch disease. And it's
you're making that up. You are trolling me. I don't appreciate it.
It was the biggest little goldfinch you ever saw. It was like a little fluffy ball. And so we pulled down the feeders. It said, you know, they can transmit it to other birds. I was just wondering if you were familiar with it and like how long should, you know, we stop feeding the finches?
I've never heard of it. Mark, have you ever heard of that? Fat finch disease?
Well, you know, being a scientist, I know it as trichomoniasis, which I just Googled. Yeah, so I'm not super – where's Stephanie Ellis when you need her? I'm not super familiar with it. I know the eye disease that house finches and goldfinches get is very well known, and you see that a lot. And I'm sure the people who follow bird diseases are like, yeah, this
is – you know what?
We see this all the time.
We will ask that question of Stephanie tomorrow, because tomorrow we are talking about wild animals with Stephanie and others. So I'll make a little note. Colleen, tune in, and we'll ask Stephanie about fat finch disease. All right.
But yeah, to her question, yeah, if you've got a diseased finch, and because they just kind of sit at a feeder, you could take it down and you know, bleach it before you put it back up after several days or whatever.
So just wait a few days? You don't have to wait very long?
Yeah, I mean, just you kind of want that diseased one to move on so it's not infecting others, and just, you know, you can bleach that feeder and then put it back up after a while.
Okay. All right. Becca in Oak Bluff says, for the first time on the vineyard, I spotted a bird I didn't know. After checking Sylvie's guide to birds, it appeared to be a black-throated warbler. What a beautiful bird. I was inside, so didn't hear it. And of course, as soon as I went outside, it was gone and haven't seen it since. But what a treat. Becca, thanks for sharing that. And then
maybe a black-throated, there's no black-throated warbler, but there's a black-throated green warbler that is coming through right now. It's one of the more common spring migrants, and I had them chasing each other around. There was zero yesterday, or maybe there was one yesterday morning, and then this morning I had three or four black-throated green warblers just right in the trees in my yard chasing each other around. They have a great song, and people, you know, a lot of people are using Merlin now. Like at this point, if you're probably already using Merlin, and it is pretty, it's really good with the warblers. But if you run it in your yard right now, it's going to tell you some things that weren't really there because it gets fooled by the catbirds. But it is really good with the warblers. Like it picked up bay-breasted warbler, which I had in my neighborhood this morning. It's really good with that. And so give it a try. You might realize that these things are just, they're really hard to see. And so the fact that she got to see a black, I'm assuming black-throated green warbler, they have a bright yellow face and then black on the throat and onto the breast, and gorgeous little birds. But they have a really distinctive song that it's one you can learn, right? If you're intimidated by the warbler songs or whatever, you don't get to practice them much. Black-throated green is one. They go, trees, trees, murmuring trees. or zee 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 zoo zee. It's this buzzy, really distinctive song where they're like saying something that lends itself to a fun mnemonic, and so zzz, 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 zzz. And so that's a black-throated green warbler, and I'll bet there's probably one singing in the neighborhoods of a lot of you people listening right now.
Yeah, good to know. All right, Barbara says, my favorite bird is the eastern towhee. I'm 5 years on the Cape from Connecticut and never saw them in Connecticut. When will they return? Also, my Mother's Day present was a new hummingbird feeder, and the hummers are a constant flow to the feeder. Love them. One even fluttered around my head as I was reading on the deck. Such a great sound. Barbara, thanks for the note. So towhees, they're around, aren't they?
Yeah, they come back in April, actually. And I didn't hear I don't know why I didn't hear a single one this morning, but they were more visible a couple of weeks ago. Like a lot of the sparrows will move earlier, and like chipping sparrows and towhees come back in April. And so by May, they're in place. And so if you're not hearing them, it may be that there just aren't any right there, or They've gotten a little quiet because they're getting nesty or whatever. But yeah, they're back.
Okay.
I love who doesn't love a towhee? Drink
Yeah.
your tea. Such a great song.
Yeah. All right, tell us about this varied bunting that was spotted in Provincetown. I'm not familiar with that bird.
Oh God, yeah. What a crazy story. It was a dark and stormy night. So I think it was like December 2nd, I got an email from someone I know up in Peaktown, Zig Plotter, Zygmunt Plotter. It's a great name, and he's a sort of a famous environmental lawyer in my circles. Anyway, was part of this case that went to the Supreme Court, the first real test of the Endangered Species Act, with a little fish called the snail darter and a dam, Tennessee Valley Authority. It's a very famous case in environmental law and test of the Endangered Species Act in the 70s, I think. But anyway, I've come to know him, and he's like, "Hey, I've got a hummingbird, and it's December 2nd." He left his feeder out, which I tell everybody to do. And that started down this bizarre road of rare birds and intrigue and secrecy, the likes of which I've never seen. So it turns out this rare hummingbird, it's obviously not the usual rare hummingbird, which is a weird thing to say, but it was not a rufous hummingbird. That's typically what the winter hummingbirds turn out to be, a rufous hummingbird that maybe was trying to fly from coastal Alaska to western Mexico and took a wrong angle and ended up on Cape Cod. This one looked like a female ruby-throated, which meant that it was probably going to be a black-chinned hummingbird, which is one of the rarest of the rare hummingbirds that show up here in winter. And sure enough, Sue Finnegan went and banded it. Like I said, she's one of two licensed hummingbird banders in the state. And it was indeed a black-chinned hummingbird. It was great, really cool. But it couldn't be public because just the neighborhood and there was nowhere to park. There was no way this could be made public to all birders. But a local in the know reporter and excellent young birder, people in P-Town know, Will Von Herf, knows Zig. And he was there with his girlfriend, who was also into environmental law and policy. And so they were hanging out and looking at the hummingbird, and they see the hummingbird attacking this bird in the bird bath. And it's this brown bird, and Will reasonably said, "Oh, that's a female indigo bunting." Indigo bunting in late December, January, maybe at that point. Just crazy. And but it got crazier because that's not what it was. And then I finally go, and I take a picture of the hummingbird, and I see the bunting, and I take pictures of it. And it looks funny. The bill looks weird. It's got this kind of curved bill. I'm like, that looks a little weird. But it's molting in a kind of a severe way. It was like missing feathers on its face. I'm like, oh, that's making the bill look weird. It's missing a lot of the feathers on the face because they hadn't grown back in yet. And then so I think I put that in an eBird list. And then one of the kind of primary eBird reviewer on the Cape is Jeremiah Trimble, who works at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology, grew up in Mashpee. And yeah, he's just one of the best birders in the country, probably.
Say in the world, yeah.
Yeah, and he's constantly reviewing photos as this high volume eBird reviewer. I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he keeps up with it, but he catches things that people miss all the time. And so I get a text message from him that just simply said, "What's up with that hunting in P-Town?" And I'm like, "Oh, I had not really downloaded all my photos. I threw it up there. Like Will, I thought it was a, assumed it was a an indigo bunting, which was kind of a reasonable thing. I actually had a brown indigo bunting winter at my feeders in Harwich one year, which was super rare. Anyway, so I'm like, oh, I should probably go back and look at my photos. Maybe it's a lazuli bunting, which is a very, very, would be crazy. But their females are kind of brownish and they're hard to tell apart. So I'm looking at it. The more I look at it and looking at the bill, I'm like, holy, I use an expletive. I use an expletive, Mindy. This looks like a varied bunting. And a varied bunting is something that you would see if you were traveling to Arizona as a bird, it would be on your list. I got to get varied bunting while I'm in Southeast Arizona. maybe parts of Texas. But it's mostly a Mexican and Central American bird that gets up into those southwestern states a little bit. And the males are this beautiful, you know, blues and reds and things. A little subtle compared to like a painted bunting. But the females are brown and they kind of look like female indigo buntings. But they have this distinctively curved bill, like the upper mandible of the bill is kind of curved. And, you know, I was like, I can't believe this. There's never been a winter record. There are only like four records of varied bunting in the entire eastern, you know, Canada and US. And they're all away from, they were all in like near the Great Lakes or Western Pennsylvania, places like that. And one on the Gulf Coast of Florida. So that's it. There's
Wow.
never been a winter record of a varied bunting anywhere in Eastern North America, you know, north of Mexico. So just a monumental, unexpected thing to be sitting at somebody's feeder with just like cheap supermarket millet mix in it. You know, this is
Yeah.
not an elaborate array of feeders and expensive seeds and what fussy, you know, it's a bird bath, some supermarket mix, and a hummingbird feeder.
Wow.
And it yielded black-chinned hummingbird bunting that turned out to be the East Coast first record of varied bunting from Mexico. And then after the hummingbird disappeared, the feeder was still out at a black-throated blue warbler. This is January.
Oh my
This
goodness.
black-throated blue warbler that is something you hope to see in May. Because come he photographs it on the feeder. He's like, what's this thing? And
Oh,
it's just
his
like
place is the
it's
place
just like
to
a
be, it sounds like.
Just at
Yeah,
like
yeah.
downtown Provincetown with no
Yeah.
fancy feeders or anything. And it's just incredible what is out there in the winter.
If you're
And
looking,
so
yeah.
the varied bunting, it had to be kept secret. It was like, you know, the people who knew about it were basically making Zig feel like he needed to be in the witness protection program about this bird.
So it's gone
And the,
now. I mean, it's not around
right.
now. Yeah. All
And
right.
the worst thing that was going to happen was this handful of mostly women birders who kind of stalk these birds that are at people's feeders. They Google the address and they kind of like go for a walk in that
Yeah.
neighborhood, just happenstance. Oh,
Yeah.
maybe I'll play a varied bunting. Like that's all that would have happened, but
Yeah.
it could have been
Could
worse
have
than that.
been
So
worse. Yeah.
anyway,
All right.
it had to be kept
All
quiet.
right, I got to go to a break. We're way over. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joe in Harwich wrote back. He says, along with the piping plover he observed last week in Harwichport, he spotted two nests, each containing four eggs, and he sent us some photos. Is that like about what you'd see in four eggs? Is that normal, average?
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's a full clutch. Sometimes you see three egg clutches are pretty common. And then sometimes what happens is they'll be laying a nest and they lay one egg every 36 hours
Oh,
on average.
okay.
So it takes several 6 days or something to lay a full clutch.
Yeah.
And sometimes what happens is a crow gets it during the laying stage and but then they'll move to a different scrape and keep laying, and so they'll just end up with like a two or three egg nest.
Okay.
Call those continuation nests, but yeah, mostly four. Yeah.
And Becca in Oak Bluffs wrote back. She said she heard you say that what you thought she saw was a black-throated green warbler. She said this bird I saw had a black head and a blue back and white chest with a few black streaks. So I guess,
Right.
yeah. So.
Yeah, sure. It was 50-50. Black-throated blue warbler is the other one. There's also a black-throated gray warbler out west. So there's a lot of black-throated warblers. I thought black-throated green was the most likely based on how many come through, but black-throated blue is, I think, one of the most beautiful birds. I think they're just fantastic, a male
Yeah.
black-throated blue. So lucky you.
Okay, let's talk to Paula calling from Mashpee. Hi, Paula.
Hey, Mindy, how's it going?
Great.
Hey, listen, I'm so glad that Mark is on this morning because I was just in on our morning walk. I saw a bird I have never seen before, and I'm sure he's going to know what it is. And the only way I know how to describe it is it's like it was a grayish colored bird with a longish slender neck. Almost looked like a young blue heron, but no, not quite. And when it took off, it had orange wings, orange feathers on the underside. It was like the size of a small cormorant, the size and shape of a small cormorant. What the heck was that?
It's funny, when you started talking, I flashed to when I had two green herons fly over my neighborhood this morning, which really unusual. I don't see green herons. I mean, I get just about everything as flyovers at one time or another. But and then the more you talked, I'm like, well, probably a green heron. And so if you're not familiar with green herons, they look like a baby heron. Mm-hmm. They're compared to a great blue heron. They're tiny and they're solitary. And but so they'll be sitting by themselves somewhere. You know, a lot of the herons are by themselves, but they nest in a solitary way. They don't join the colony, the mixed colonies of great blue herons or, you know, egrets and things that all nest together. So they'll quietly nest in the in a tree next to a pond or whatever. And they're around. They come back. They're not here in the winter like great blue herons are. They come back in late April, early May. And if you get it in good light, it's not gray at all. I mean, it really is green and russet, you know, this kind of rufousy color, and they're shiny. I mean, they're a spectacular bird if you get it in the right light and get a good look at it. And they're interesting birds. They're famous for using bait for fishing. I'm serious. I kid you not.
Wow.
So, and there are YouTube videos of this from years ago. And so green herons would figure out that, you know, they'd be at a pond where people are feeding the ducks, and they figured out that they could take a piece of bread, pick it up, and put it down on the top of the water as bait. And then when a fish comes up to get the bread, they nab it.
Hmm.
They're literally fishing with bait with that little pea-sized bird brain. Don't underestimate them.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, I saw this one in a flooded bog over in the Willowbend area of Mashpee.
Mm-hmm.
And they have orange feathers under them?
I don't know.
Might be the way the light hit it.
It's always
difficult
to interpret what people are saying that they saw. If, you know, if you're not a birder and you're not used to describing birds, it doesn't always translate. So maybe it was something else. Maybe I'm missing something obvious, but that was my best guess.
Yeah, Paula, Google it. Okay. Take a look at the picture, and you'll probably know by looking at that if that's what you saw. Thanks, but thanks for the call.
Okay.
Thanks. All right. Thanks. Tor Hansen's giving us a call. Hi, Tor.
Hi, Tor. Hi there, Mindy Todd, and good morning to Mark. Thanks for having
me. Hello, Tor.
So, you were talking. Well, I just picked up on, I have a wonderful shot of a juvenile green heron, and it's so decorative with its feathers, the flossy feathers from Beach Forest, the back pond. But also, I wondered, you were talking about the varied bunting. So when I was at 2009 in Louisiana at that great rookery, is just when you get over the bridge onto Grand Isle, there is a wonderful rookery. And there I was able to get, all of the birds coming in off the gulf. And I happened to see in a tree with indigo buntings, the one that we call the cardinaline hybrid that you may be familiar with. And I had to send you a picture of it, and it has white mottled in with the blue. And I'm wondering, was it molting, or do we have a real good example of what Sibley shows us clearly as a cardinaline hybrid?
Oh, interesting question. Mark, do you know the answer?
You mean like the genus of the finches, the cardinaline? I don't actually know. I don't. I'd have to see the picture, Tor, to see what you're talking about.
Yeah,
and it's something to look forward to, and I was hoping you might know it. And Sibley has a picture of it, and it's a wonderful hybrid. I think it's an indigo. It's probably crossed with a lazuli bunting, but I'll take another look. And the other thing, yesterday I was in Beach Forest, and I did notice the only a few warblers coming through, and I think somebody said they had seen the black paw. The palms and the black and whites and the pines have already gone through. Myrtles, so many myrtles, but are we in a shortage? Are we seeing that there's not as many warblers coming our way through Beach Forest, which is an old, wonderful treasure trove?
Yeah. Tor, thanks for that. Thanks for the call. Mark?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's different. It's everything is weather dependent here on the Cape with migration. Like the average migrant wants to be in Ohio, not Cape Cod right now. They like to go straight up through the middle of the country if they can. The trees are more leafed out. There's probably more insects the more inland you go. You know, we know that spring comes reluctantly to the Cape. And so what we see is what the weather gives us, right? The mm-hmm. winds and whatever. And we get our warblers every year. Sometimes there's, you know, many days where you don't see anything and then we see them. But if you go to beach forest enough, you'll see all the stuff. And, mm-hmm. You know, I've heard, saw somebody recently online saying, oh, this is the most warblers I've seen in years at some place that's closer to, I think maybe on the North Shore. So it's really variable. But it's really just beginning now. So I think it's best at mid-May and to the end of the month is really the best here on the Cape, where you can consistently expect to see warblers. Sometimes we don't get the right winds for the first half of May, and you're just waiting and waiting, waiting like it's been. But the last couple of days, it seems like it's opened up. And while warblers have been trickling in to places like the beach forest, it should just get better and better. Mm-hmm. But then by June, it's over. I mean, it's quick. Yeah, I mean, the last of the migrants to show up in at the end of the month in early June are some of the flycatchers, like, you know, willow flycatchers and eastern wood peewees and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then it's over.
Yeah. Moving from birds to horseshoe crabs, I know you were doing, you're working on some horseshoe crab surveys. What are you finding? I know it's not, you don't have all of your information yet, but give us a little indication of what you're seeing.
Yeah, yeah. So the surveys just started Saturday. The spawning surveys that we've done for many years and that other people do. And so I oversee about half the spawning survey sites in Massachusetts that where we collect data that goes to the Division of Marine Fisheries, and they use it to try to, you know, figure out what to do with horseshoe crab populations, along with some other data that they have. And so it's around the full moons and new moons in May and June is when the surveys are. I don't think the crabs care that much about the moons up here. The lore around horseshoe crabs is like, on full moon nights, they come ashore. And it's not really that at all. It's more about weather. In some of the places on the Cape, they don't even like the really high tides because there's no beach anymore.
Right.
The water's lapping up against rock walls and things. They can't do anything with that. And so, you know, nice calm when the water is above 50 and even more when it's above 60, they'll come in and spawn. And we do these systematic surveys on certain days, certain tides. Everybody does the same ones. We've done it for many years. They kind of track them over time. And, you know, the Cape Cod Bay population has just been really bottomed out for a long time with little signs of recovery. So our point is the population is so far below the threshold needed to actually provide the ecological services that they've historically provided to shorebirds, especially that eat the eggs, but fish and everything else. We're sort of taking advantage of the resilience of horseshoe crabs. You cannot drive these things extinct. They tried.
Yeah, you know,
they literally
got about,
tried
you got
to
about
eradicate
20
them.
Seconds, Mark, and we have
20
to wrap
seconds.
Yeah, so wrap
yeah,
it up.
This is
yeah.
usually an hour long lecture that I give Mindy. So maybe we'll save this for another
we'll
time.
We'll save it for next month then. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But they're out there spawning. So if you want to see some, go take a look on a nice high tide, on a nice calm, warm day.
There you go. All right. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.